It's Christina LaChance, who is Christina is a research coordinator in the social behavioral research branch at the National Human Genome Research Institute at NIH. She received her MPH from the Boston University of Public Health, and her talk is titled "Informational Content of Websites Offering Health-Related Genetic Tests Direct to Consumers." Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here tonight. And I think we're going to be switching gears a little from racial and ethnic disparities to looking at disparities in literacy. And I have no relationships to disclose. So tonight I'm going to tell you a little bit about a content analysis our team undertook to examine the informational content, usability, and literacy levels of direct-to-consumer genetic testing websites. And since many of you are probably familiar with DTC genetic testing, I'll give a very brief background and then move on to our research questions and methods. I'll highlight some select results both for all of the sites we sampled and then broken down by test type offered. And finally, I'll discuss our conclusions. So as you probably know, direct-to-consumer genetic testing refers to genetic tests that are marketed directly to consumers, mostly via the internet, though at least one company has done a print advertisement campaign. And this form of genetic testing provides access to a person's genetic information without involving a doctor's visit or a health insurance company in the process, although a few companies do make genetic counselors available. Researchers have predicted personalized medicine's potential to transform healthcare, and DTC companies have embraced this, framing the service they offer in terms of consumer power and calling it a healthcare revolution and the democratization of genetic information. So what started out as a handful of companies has now grown to somewhere between 3 to 5 dozen. And this image illustrates the testing process that is used by most companies. And though they were initially much more expensive, the average cost of these tests is currently around $400, though you can pay as little as $100 or as much as $100,000, should you be inclined. And there are tests for many different health conditions offered. There are susceptibility tests for a wide range of common chronic conditions and diseases, tests for the more traditional single gene disorders, and also for traits such as bitter taste perception and freckling. These companies have received quite a bit of media coverage within the past 5 years, and as we heard earlier, someone else mentioned, last year Time Magazine named 23andMe's retail DNA test the best invention of 2008. So it's not surprising that there is increasing awareness of this type of testing both among consumers and providers. And an analysis of two national surveys done by Kohler and colleagues in 2008 showed that of the over 5,000 consumer respondents surveyed, about 22% said they'd heard of DTC genetic testing, though only 16 had actually undergone testing themselves. And of the almost 2,000 healthcare providers surveyed, 42% reported being aware of it. 118 of these had had a patient bring in test results to them, and 3/4 of these docs reported those results changing some aspect of the patient's care, such as the prescriptions they wrote, the screening tests they offered, or the lifestyle recommendations they made. So this implies that this type of testing could impact how providers are already delivering care to their patients. While the companies claim that DTC genetic testing is empowering, academic researchers, bioethicists, and medical societies have vocally criticized aspects of the services they provide. They state that the science is not ready for prime time. They raise concerns about the clinical validity and utility of these tests, that the tests are not validated in diverse populations because most of the GWAS data comes from Caucasians. There are privacy concerns, such as who actually has access to a customer's DNA. And there's a concern about the lay public interpreting complex results without the help of a trained genetics professional, which could lead to misinterpretation and confusion on the part of the consumer. And just in general, it's uncertain how people will or should use the information that they're getting from these tests. One group of consumers that's been overlooked in the current debate about DTC genetic testing is that of adults with limited literacy. It can be expected that as the cost of genome sequencing decreases and DTC companies continue to lower the price of their services, more and more people will find DTC genetic testing not only desirable but also affordable. It's been estimated that around 90 million American adults have limited literacy, which is about half the adult population of this country and therefore a substantial proportion of Americans. And furthermore, like other information and medicine, genetics terminology is filled with jargon and abstract biological concepts that even highly educated people have a hard time understanding. So it's likely that an even greater number of adults have limited genetic literacy, though little research has been done to date in this area, although it sounds like from this meeting some people are actually looking into that, so that's exciting. We also know that studies have established that many adults, even those who have achieved high education, struggle with low numeracy skills and have difficulty understanding the probabilistic numbers that characterize genetic information. And in the meanwhile, the internet has greatly increased access to public access to genetic health information. And data has shown that people with limited literacy do access the internet, and as many as 42% of these users obtain some health information from internet sources. Research has also demonstrated that people with limited literacy frequently encounter substantial barriers when seeking health information online. So if one of the main goals of DTC genetic testing is to democratize health information for everyone, it would be important for DTC companies to present web-based content that is appropriate for consumers with a wide range of literacy and numeracy skills on their websites. So while there have been other, while there have been other content analyses done concerning the ethical and policy implications of this type of testing, we decided to take a slightly different angle and examine the features of DTC genetic testing websites that contribute to difficulties with reading and comprehension of the information being provided. And we did this by asking two research questions. The first one was, does the informational content of these websites meet the recommendations set forth by the professional associations? And the second was, does the format and readability of the sites meet established web usability and literacy standards? So to answer the first research question and to evaluate the content on the websites, we used recommendations that have been put forth by a number of professional medical societies that you can see listed at the bottom. And these guidelines seek to establish standards for the responsible provision of DTC genetic testing. They recommend that the companies give transparent and accurate information on the validity of tests and limitations of the science upon which they are based, disclose fully all the risks and benefits of undergoing testing, maintain the privacy of consumers' information, disclose the clinical evidence for behavior change recommendations, and involve a trained genetics professional. And at the time of our study, these were the only guidelines for this type of testing that had been published. To evaluate the literacy demand and usability features of the website, we relied on guidelines created by health literacy experts that seek to direct the design of health communication materials so that they're accessible to a wide range of users. And this is an image of the research-based web and usability guidelines that's put out by HHS, which is one resource that we consulted. And some of the recommendations that they make include writing the information at a 6th to 8th grade level, making the organization, style, and appearance of the sites accessible, using navigational elements that help users easily move through a website, and using an organizational structure that places the most important information first on a site. So moving on to our methods. We searched for sites offering tests for health conditions related to common, chronic, or rare diseases, and we used two resources to locate DTC genetic testing sites. First, we consulted the table of DTC genetic testing companies that is updated by the Genetics and Public Policy Center, and then we also did our own comprehensive web search. These two methods yielded a sample of 29 direct-to-consumer genetic testing websites that were all in English. We then created a study codebook and pilot tested it extensively over 3 months using 4 DTC websites that we'd excluded from our sample. We examined site content based on the recommendations that were made by the professional societies I mentioned earlier, and we also evaluated site usability and administered readability formulas to assess literacy demand. 2 coders independently coded each of the websites, and we calculated intercoder agreement and set a 70% threshold. So moving on to results, the DTC genetic testing websites offered 3 main categories of test types. 7 offered whole genome SNP scans, which are scans of up to 100,000 SNPs, and we also lumped the whole genome sequencing sites into this category. 15 offered a scan of 1 or more SNPs, and the remaining 7 offered tests for known single gene mutations or clinically available chromosome testing, such as that for cystic fibrosis. And some of the sites offered more than one type of testing, combination of tests, and we classified them according to the type of test they offered most frequently. So in these tables, I present results for all 29 sites, which is in the first column, and then also break them down into the three categories of test type offered. And the first results I'd like to highlight deal with whether the companies are providing the consumer with adequate information to truly empower them to make an informed decision. As you can see here, for the variable of providing scientific evidence to support marker selection, less than 40% of all sites overall provided such evidence, and only about 1/5 cited specific peer-reviewed scientific publications. Breaking it down by test type offered, the SNP-based sites were the most likely to provide scientific evidence at 53%, And the whole genome sites were more likely to cite specific publications to support marker selection. Another relevant result relates to what the companies present as the risk and benefits of undergoing testing. And as you can see here in the first column, while virtually all of the sites listed at least one benefit to testing, only slightly more than half provided at least one limitation. Some sites did better than others in providing information on limitations, as you can see in the whole genome scan column. But keep in mind that we set the bar pretty low, only having to disclose one limitation. And there are obviously more than one. In regard to the involvement of healthcare providers, few sites offered their customers the opportunity for a consultation with a genetics professional either before or after testing. Breaking it down by test type, you can see the sites testing for known mutations were slightly more likely to offer consultation with a healthcare provider after testing. That's the 43% in the very last column. Only 21% of all sites provided guidance on their website advising healthcare providers how to interpret and apply their patients' DTC testing results. And there weren't big differences by site type for this variable. Regarding privacy, the majority of sites provided some mention of privacy or provided their entire privacy policy, but these policies were often filled with legal jargon, and many of them dealt more with protecting the consumer's financial information than their DNA. And then just looking at the last two variables, though many of the companies identified who founded the company and who was behind them, who was on their board of CEOs, the role of their scientific collaborators was much less clear, especially regarding who would have access to the customer's DNA during the testing process. Some results to highlight in regard to the usability and literacy findings. Only about 40% of all sites presented content, the majority of which was related to a testing decision. Many sites had lots of other content on their pages, such as promotional content, testimonials, recreational content, such as ancestry mapping. Whole genome sites did do slightly better in this category. We also assumed that the websites would be providing their customers with sample risk estimates for the results, so they would know what to expect when they get them by email. But we found that less than one-third of sites presented at least one sample risk estimate, though again, the whole genome sites did do slightly better on this. Our results for literacy demand demonstrate that much of the information is provided at quite an advanced level. Only 7% or two sites used common language most of the time and fully explained technical terms. And breaking it down, you can see that every site type did really poorly on this variable. And furthermore, as we'd suspected, the readability levels of these sites was really high, averaging out to about a grade 15, which is equivalent to around the junior year of college. And you may remember that the literacy guidelines had recommended writing information about an eighth grade reading level, so this is quite above that. The sites did do a decent job with graphics, though less than half presented graphics on their site, which supported the key content information. And things we looked for here were random graphics that didn't really illustrate any of the key points being made on the page, such as, or just using unfamiliar objects like double helixes or lab equipment pictures. It's also noticeable that in spite of the high reading level on these sites, not many provided assistance to users in the form of glossaries or tutorials. The whole genome sites were more likely to provide tutorials, but these often presented content that could be considered genetics 101 and didn't really deal with interpreting the risk information or understanding the risk level any better. So the limitations of our study include that they were English-only sites. We did not directly assess comprehension among a group of consumers. The readability formulas can yield imprecise grade-level estimates. And intercoder agreement for a few of the key variables was slightly lower than the 70% threshold that we had set. So to sum up, in this content analysis, we observed a wide range in the quality of informational content, as well as literacy and usability-related information across the health-related DTC testing sites. While there was some variation among sites according to the type of testing they offered, and some seemed to be making an attempt to distinguish themselves, even the quote-unquote best sites still had a number of areas upon which they could improve. And it appears that although guidelines for DTC testing and health literacy have been widely published, few of these companies adopted them when designing their web platforms. And our findings provide empirical support for many of the recent critiques of the DTC testing companies that have appeared in the scientific literature. And I'd just like to acknowledge my co-authors, Lori Irby, who's a genetic counselor at Johns Hopkins University, and my colleagues at NHGRI, Kim Kepping, Vincent Allen, and Beth Ford. Thank you very much.
Yes?
health sites, and many genetic counselors or geneticists would, in many cases, do rate very poorly on those same criteria. So I'm wondering, this is a bit of an opinion question, what is your opinion on places, and obviously they're selling something,
right,
on places though that there could be something gained by looking at what some of these sites are doing, maybe better than average? Are there those areas, or are they all below?
Yeah, that's a hard one because I'm a little biased from the start. I think one of the important lessons learned for educational websites, you know, organizations that are doing genetics education, is that things should be written at a much lower level to be more accessible. And again, to provide information to users, maybe in a layered format. It seems like websites lend themselves really easily to presenting information, you know, a little bit first, and then people can kind of further explore if they want to, and not become overwhelmed by the amount, you know, of information they're seeing. But on these websites, and I haven't explored that many of the education ones, it was really hard to kind of find that logical path of, oh, I want to find the risk information, so where do I go first? Like, what's cueing me to find that? You just would have to surf and surf and surf and click and click and click, and it would take a lot of time and energy. And if you're not that savvy to begin with, you probably wouldn't find it at all. So that's one of the negatives. I really can't think of any positives off the top of my head. They had really good flash, like, animation and, like, very entertaining things. They clearly had very good graphic designers working for them, which I know is something a lot of education people can't afford.
Which is great. I mean, that's kind of, like, how can we not lose the money?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes?
I just have a question, and I may have missed it. When did you guys perform this?
So we did this, yeah, I don't know if I said that, sorry, this spring of 2008, so it's pretty recent.
Yeah, because I guess in the last year or so, these companies have been given like a public smackdown about their education, and it's specifically on the scientific literature, so that may go up actually for the whole genome scans at least.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have been arguing that to me, that they're going to improve, but I really don't know that they will, because again, they're selling something, and they want to be very persuasive, and really outlining the risks and benefits, or even being more clear about what they're offering, just may not be what they're looking to do.
I think specifically the ones that are more popular have been getting a lot of criticism about that.
Yeah.
So they may get better, but
I would hope so, but yeah. I'm not that confident. Yes?
I have heard that there are some who would really like to see genetic testing registries as mandatory, so that everybody is providing genetic tests would have to register. Mm-hmm. I think something like that would actually maybe help standardize.
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't really, like, regulation and stuff, we didn't really touch on in this analysis, but I know that a lot of work is being done in that. I think tomorrow there's a session that will probably discuss more of those aspects.
Okay, just a point about that is that I guess registries are used to collect information about health and disease, but an argument that companies might use is that they're not really providing information that's disease-related. It falls into other categories. It's one way to sidestep that.
Yeah, they're actually, many of them are gathering information for their own research purposes.
Right.
That's the stated reason why they're offering that testing. But
right. Thank you.
So, we have a couple more minutes, actually, and I'm, you know, don't want to lose time that we could use for good discussion. One of the questions I had, though, is one of the goals of the Genomics Forum, which is the group that is the primary sponsor of this session, is to not just silo genetics, but think about it more broadly in terms of public health and what we can learn from other groups and what we can bring. And so I guess one of the questions I have for all the presenters is, what of your presentations would you say was the best, most broadly applicable thing you learned to public health in general? And what did you learn that is most applicable beyond just genetics research and genetic services? And I don't know that it's recording or anything, so people don't really need to come up, but that's okay. You have the easiest job, which
I was
is
trying to figure out how to load my DTC.
So how is your work more broadly applicable to public health, the public health community in general, and not just genetic services?
I think because with budget cuts at the state level, you know, our state's cutting things like our child abuse screening program. So that's how serious our cuts are. That the Vancouver Island then stand no chance of getting specialist pediatric specialty services. So if we can show a model where we can show that services can be provided using different methods and still maintain a high level of service with good satisfaction of the provider and the family, then we can make sure that those families continue to receive services where they are, and then bring in the kids that really need to be brought in and save money that way.
Great. Anyone else? June, do you want to go? It is getting late.
No, I think that, I mean, you know, people can argue with me about this or not, but more and more sort of genetics oriented and racialized stuff is getting developed. And, you know, you can go to these DTC sites and see how a person's ancestry testing and as well as their risk testing is just side by side. They actually end up informing each other as well as having implications for how relevant that information is for a consumer. And so to some extent, we have to be thoughtful about how we navigate this time, where race and ancestry in particular are being woven together in interesting ways, sometimes for good, and I think sometimes not so good. And that's where I think it's relevant for us to just examine those cases as they come up.
Great. Where's everyone else hiding?
I think the larger context of just being aware of literacy and disparities. With literacy and making sure that the tools we produce are appropriate for a wide range of users and not only, you know, writing to people who assume can understand college level language.
Okay. Sue?
I piggyback on what Tivoli just said, is that we need to be very careful not to start profiling based on race for genetics, because it's not the same thing, and it's very easy, could be very easy for us to fall into profiling by race or ethnicity when it's genetics, it's a biological piece. There's similarities, but there's also a very large variety within every racial group as well. And we have to be very careful not to put the two together. Thanks.
Great. Does anyone else have questions kind of pertaining to that topic or another for the presenters, or thoughts for that matter?
I'd just say that I think this is something that was discussed recently at CDC, but from a Dr. Meigs from Harvard. He was basically giving a speech on diabetes and talking about genetic discoveries. But he was saying that genetics can be seen as the thing that makes us unique, but it's also the thing that binds us together. Biologically, we have mechanisms that are identical in terms of glucose and metabolism and other things like that. And the genetics can actually help tie us together and show those biological similarities as well.
Absolutely.
I just had a concern. I saw recently that somebody, maybe a health care organization, partnered with 23andMe in California. And I was wondering what kind of implications that has, partnering with a hospital, given that these tests are based on non-diverse populations. And why would they do that?
Well, I think people in the audience have a lot of information on this. And I believe it's two points. One was the health communication portions of it, kind of the multimedia and the explaining risk that we were discussing, so that the hospital system felt woefully inadequate to do that. And then I think that they had piloted it with the health professionals within that system. I seem to remember hearing that session at ASHG. Does anyone else? I think it was Mayo.
Yeah, they
did a study to look at the healthcare professionals in their own organization to see if they were interested or willing to uptake and take it on. Like, so their population was specifically Mayo employees. So they didn't go out and try to recruit populations outside of the clinic.
Well, for a beta.
Yeah,
for a
baseline kind of thing. And I don't know where it's going to go from there, but yeah, absolutely. You know, it opens a whole can of worms.
Right. And I think that's the issue of something I think we struggle with as a community sometimes, as a public health community, is the question of where do we want to separate industry because they have different interests, and where do we want to not other them because we lose some of the things that they develop, and they also, you lose some of the accountability because you're othering them, so they're other. Where is that balance? I actually think that health communication is a huge one because they're the ones putting the most money into that risk communication piece.
So it's just recreational. We didn't know that doctors were changing the care they provide. I would, you know, not take them so seriously in public health standards, but because it is a medical service and it's clearly influencing, has a potential influence how people are, you know, taking care of themselves, I feel like it is our, you know, responsibility to kind of step in.
Would you say, and this out of curiosity based upon that question, that the partnership with Mayo Clinic will improve 23andMe's ability to do that, or is it to...
Yeah, I don't know much about what their intentions are. I'm hoping that because of the repute of the organizations that have partnered with them, maybe the bars will be raised, but I just don't trust this company, so...
Right.
Not the person to ask. You have to remember, 23andMe, they're partners. Their founders are Stanford Medical Center, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not like they're some fly-by-night... non-degree, non-genetics kind of people that are on their board and people that work with them, they're based out of Stanford. So Stanford is pretty good.
But they're a private company. Right. I mean, it's not clear what board, how much of their board influences as far as what their product is. It's really, I mean, they don't really disclose that very well on the website. It's publicly accessible.
Right, it's that transparency.
It's changing. The AB's gone, and they've hired genetic counselors. It changes every month.
Clear Google connection that you cannot deny. That's creepy.
And there are other. there are other examples too. I believe DNA Direct is partnering with a healthcare company, and they were a little. They always had genetic counselors, yet another example of kind of. I think some of it is that is economic, but some of it is also looking at these kind of these public-private partnerships or what have you.
It may not be such an awful thing as they start partnering with actual healthcare organizations to finally make that line in the sand that says, yes, this is a medical test, and really start getting some rules laid down about regulation of what it is that they're doing, as opposed to being, this is just for fun.
For your information.
For your information, and it's clearly medically relevant, and it's starting to influence medical decisions, maybe this could actually be a good thing.
There's no regulation of laboratory-developed tests like that. The FDA doesn't regulate it.
Yeah, that funny place where the Venn diagram doesn't overlap between FDA and CMS.
Pretty big place, actually, yeah.
And that was notable in her presentation, only 45% of the labs were clear certified.
Right.
It's less than
that. Right.
States have some power over that.
Yes. And some of them have taken initial steps. It also brings to mind the idea of where have other public health institutions gone through similar experiences with this balance of, because these companies exist and provide a large portion of services. You know, where have other areas of public health had similar challenges and what have they done with it? A question I don't have the answer to, but it's a good place to get it.
I mean, newborn screening goes through that because we have commercial interest in newborn screening now. We'll do newborn screening and we'll go into the state and take over the state program, but don't provide the follow-up services like the state program used to do in the past. They only provide the laboratory service, and then you're kind of stopped because you have a result, but no one to follow up.
You mean like the former Neogen?
It's called Perkin-Elmer Genetics now, I think.
What? One last question?
I was just going to go back to the first thing you were saying. I think you were talking about not siloing health and newborn screening is a perfect long time example of that. And it's interesting to think about what other screening programs or genetic screening tests could get incorporated into larger programs in the future, and what how is that going to happen? How is that going to be dealt with? All the issues that are going to be raised by that.
Right. I mean, in a way, genetics is kind of right now this. It like finds these problems, the lack of regulation, because certainly in testing, genetics is the one that gets the most attention right now, but there's a lot of direct-to-consumer testing of other kinds that I think genetics really is bringing this into the spotlight, and what does that look like? So very, very interesting. So I'm going to use this chance too to say that Genomics Forum is having two public events, networking events tonight. There's some of these right here and then right outside the door. One, the first one is at 6:30 tonight, and there's another one tomorrow night at 6:30 at Estia Restaurant at 1405 Locust Street. I'll be going there wandering and trying to use my phone to find my way if anyone wants to follow me. exactly. That wasn't a big vote of confidence in myself, either. But I would like to welcome everyone to join us to continue some of these discussions and what are the hot topics kind of for the coming year that we can all engage in. And just finally to say thank you so much to all of our speakers today and all of you for joining us. So have a good rest of the meeting, and I hope to see you all tonight.